If you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome back to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have Josh Neal on the show. Josh Neal is the author of American Extremist, Psychology of Political Extremism, published by Imperium Press. Josh, how are you doing?
I'm doing quite well. I'm pleased to be your guest. And these are indeed very interesting times.
Supposedly it's a curse. So.
Oh, yes. The Chinese saying, may you live in interesting times.
Yeah, as things progress, I yearn for a more quiet, boring time. I think a lot of, for America, things have never been boring. It just, on the surface, it appeared that way. There's a lot going on just beneath the surface in American history, particularly in the 20th century. It's just becoming more apparent now to the general population that something is indeed wrong. Frank Zappa observed, he said, the illusion of freedom and liberty will be maintained as long as it's profitable. The moment it's not profitable, the stage settings will be removed, the curtain will be pulled back, and the brick wall will make itself apparent, something to that effect. And maybe that's what we're seeing now in America. But you've written this book, American Extremist. It's sort of a clinical analysis of maybe what's wrong with our society. You've taken sort of a psychoanalytical approach to it, a lot of Freud in there. So I'll let you take it from there.
Sure. So yeah, it's pretty fortuitous that the book was published early this year, only a few short weeks after the events of January 6th. And when I started writing it a little over a year ago, things really hadn't kicked off to put us in the position that we're in now. It was pre Ahmed Arbery, that seems like a decade ago, with everything that's happened since then. It was pre Ahmed Arbery, pre George Floyd, the riots. You'll have to maybe cue me in on what I can and can't say. I'm not sure what platform this will be on, but the election, all of these kinds of things that happened with more than a little bit of controversy. I'm writing this book all throughout it. And I just kind of felt like...
feel free to express yourself, by the way. I'm not censored at all.
Okay.
So.
Okay. I just felt a wave of confirmation bias just rushing over me as the months passed. Because I'm like, okay. When I started, I was a little bit nervous about the hypothesis I was presenting and how it might be received. And as time went on, I was like, okay, let's just get this thing done. Nice and timely so that people can read it. My original goal was to have it out before the election, but the scope of the project kind of kept expanding and shrinking over time. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a pretty simple idea. It's not really a complex set of arguments I'm making in the book. Basically, I'm trying to wrestle some of these concepts that are used against normal average people, and it's a kind of, I guess you could say, psychological warfare that employing certain kinds of rhetorical devices in the book. I draw very heavily from a Polish psychiatrist, Andrzej Lobaczewski, who terms these kinds of people spellbinders. They use this kind of hermeneutic linguistic device to propagandize those classes and individuals that they want dominion over with one meaning of the rhetoric. And then there's this, you know, esoteric or hermeneutic meaning that is retained only for themselves and maybe their inner circle of confidants and collaborators. So American Extremist is really about how America itself is this very extreme place. And the ideologies that America perpetuates are very extreme. And the kind of extremism that we seem to be so concerned with, if you want to use the example of the insurrectionists at January 6th, those people really couldn't be considered extremists, not in the sense of the word that we often hear it. So my definition of political extremism is it's really any kind of maladaptive, antisocial, bordering on psychopathic conduct. So you could think of Dylann Roof. You could think of, oh my goodness, that kid from Hollywood who's now famous, like the Incel Manifesto kid, whose name escapes me at the moment. I think he was son of a screenwriter, biracial Asian and a white kid. Ethan? Anyway, point doesn't matter. We were taught that, you know, well, these extremists, they're, you know, they're violent. They're going to bomb schools, kill and stab civilians or whatever. But extremism is really a lot broader than that. It's really the perpetuation of any system or idea, moral conduct, which destroys communities, destroys nations, destroys civilizations. And I don't see at this point in particular how you can look at American hegemony and not see that as fundamentally the most extremist institution on the planet. And if you're, say, coming from a right-wing perspective, it's even easier to look at journalists, academics, the political class, the media class, and say, well, they're really extreme. I think many people, even if they're not particularly astute socially or politically, look at that and think, this is really, you know, this is a bridge too far. But I also turn attention in the book to, you know, what some people might call conservative ink, institutional, you know, right-wing American hegemony, which doesn't on its face seem extreme, because they'll talk about things like God and family and the market, which maybe to most listeners will seem like good, healthy, natural things. But then what do they actually do? Well, they hollow out the middle and working class. They perpetuate these philosophies of money that are corrosive. They're actually corrosive to, I mean, we see it, the birth rate is plummeting in this country and around the world. The happiness index in the United States has precipitously declined. And something I, back when I was teaching in universities, I shared with my students to everyone's horror, is that even the life expectancy of Americans has declined. Life expectancy among the two kinds of demographics that you wouldn't expect, white women and white men. Now the data I'm referencing goes back to, I think, 2017, 2018. So I actually haven't looked at it in a while, but as recently as 2 or 3 years ago, you know, the life expectancy of the average white woman had dropped 3 or 4 years. And the life expectancy of men has been on a pretty steep decline.
As well as their fertility. Yeah.
And we're dealing with deaths of despair, suicide rate for preteen children, particularly young girls, is astronomical. The your average 12-year-old American has the same kind of psychiatric well-being as a basically as someone who was institutionalized in the 1950s. So the levels of anxiety and despair of the average person are at the same level of people who were institutionalized because of lack of spiritual well-being, mental health, 60, 70 years ago. So what else could you say about a culture or a country that presides over a population with those kinds of problems, other than that's really, really extreme?
Yes, and it's almost designed to promote mental illness, as problematic as that term, you know, is. It's there to promote anxiety, fear, and destroy morale, deny people meaning. A lot of it has to do just with the nature of the neoliberal system itself. America, Americans are highly mobile. They don't have any community. And because of that, they have no, they're unrooted, they're deracinated. And so, and of course, I think a certain, the elite prefer that because that makes them more easily, more malleable, easy to manipulate and to exploit.
Yeah, it's as we are increasingly under the sway of, the cult of reason, people have increasingly fewer reasons to have fealty to these kind of provincial, archaic modes of life, like your neighborhood, your family, your community, loyalty, faith. These are perennial values, and they're certainly not values that are completely have been totally defenestrated from our world. Other cultures have them and glorify them, but in the West, in America, where we have this extreme instrumental kind of rationalism, there's no reason to do anything that isn't in advancement of the individual, the self. And that's one of the kind of sources I go to in the book is Christopher Lash, who, when he wrote The Culture of Narcissism, specifically targeted the self as the center of the decaying spiritual, social, psychological well-being of America, because there's just this extreme, narcissus, there's this extreme preoccupation with, individual subjectivity, the way I feel, the way I think, my conception of the world. To a degree of solipsism that, I'm not a historian or an anthropologist, but I struggle to find any historical comparison to the way that average Americans live today. So you have this like extreme focus on the self, and so there's no reason to care about, say, declining birth rates or really any of the problems that we're confronted with. And I'm a little bit of two minds on this issue because on one level, it's not really your or my responsibility to care about those things. It actually would be a hallmark of a extremely neurotic type for you or I to fixate on climate change, birth rates, the impending market collapse due to inflation. Like, that's not our job. That's people who have a higher station in life. That's their responsibility to manage those things. But they, the elite class, don't really see that as their responsibility. And as we're kind of saying before we started recording, the foundations, the philosophical foundations of our country really put us where we are today. And you, like, this is one of the problems with like the Ben Shapiro types of the world, where they just want to say, oh, it's these blue haired whack jobs, or it's the university, or it's MTV, if you want to go back a few decades. Mm-hmm. It's always some relatively, fresh-faced babe on the stage that mucked up the party for everybody. But you can trace everything that is going on, and I do so modestly in the book, to the foundational ideas of this country. So, like, it's not really our responsibility to care about these things, but the American tradition, the project has progressed to this point where it has become our responsibility, our moral duty, to care about these things. And so we're placed in a weird position, because I think with the elite class clearly not caring about advancing those issues in sane ways, it's doubly put upon us to try to rectify these issues. However, ill-advised or heroic that pursuit might be, I mean, it's one of the reasons I wrote this book and started my own modest broadcasting career. I just looked around and I felt this sense of, well, nobody else is really doing this, or nobody else is taking these problems with the kind of gravitas and seriousness that is required of them. Like when I started 2016, it was still it was both profitable and good to do these snarky, like Mark Dice style videos about, look at this obese woman who, is wearing this wacky refugees welcome sign and just doing all this scoffing, uninsightful, unintrospective commentary. It's people like that are why this book exists. And I'm going to take a leap here. Maybe it's why you're doing this as well. I don't know. You tell me.
Yeah. There's a point that Christopher Caldwell makes in his book. What's the title of his most recent book? He wrote about the Civil Rights Revolution.
I even quote it in the book, and I can't remember.
Entitlement? Culture of Entitlement?
That's the one.
Age of Entitlement. I'm fusing Culture of Narcissism, Age of Entitlement. And he talks about how, if you look at, I don't know how old you are, but I remember in the 90s, that's when political correctness started to really show its face, become a public issue. And it was really a target of a lot of ridicule. The right made a lot of fun of it, the same way that Mark Dice would make fun, of some of these misfits. And while it was making fun of it, and it was deservedly getting a lot of ridicule, it wasn't being dethroned or kicked out of institutions. It was sort of settling in, taking over. So this is Rush Limbaugh's career is a great example of this, where you can make fun of these people, the so-called feminazis and the environmentalist wackos, and the civil rights grifters and these characters, but they were ascendant and they successfully took over. Now, of course, the purple-haired lady is now running your corporation's human resource department, and it's being and these wacko ideas are effectively being implemented. If not through the courts, if not legislatively, through human resource policies, the corporations are just woke capital in these things. So they took over. They continued their long march through the institutions. You needed more than just ridicule, because you needed people to really take it seriously, because behind them was a lot of money, a lot of power. These so-called freaks or losers are empowered because people above want them, because they're there to smash the middle. This is that bio-Leninist approach, bio-Leninism that we see being, implemented in the country. And it's sort of a lumpen proletariat they're creating. You mentioned how, it's not our job to worry about, monetary debasement or demographic decline, birth rates. But look, the thing is that there are a lot of people who are focused on that, and to the extent that they're focused on that, they've weaponized it. They actually weaponized demographic warfare with policies which discourage fertility, antinatalist policies, not just chemical toxins, but also cultural, with the permissive culture degeneracy. But with, obviously you can do a lot with monetary debasement to discourage savings, which with cost of living and taxes and debt. It's very hard to start a family if you're heavily in debt, and that's been weaponized there. Demographics. I mean, I think you referred in the book about that SPLC, Mark Potok, in that documentary. He's cheerfully charting the decline of the white majority. Why would they be cheering that? obviously there's an agenda afoot. So we can't expect the mass population, even the majority, to concern themselves or to be well informed on it. There is an elite, malevolent group that is concerned about it for a reason.
Yeah, the Mark Potok. I mean, I remember watching that documentary when it hit I guess it was Netflix or whatever. And that was very disturbing. It made the rounds on social media. And I kind of earmarked that as something that I would have to incorporate in my work in some way, because it's so visually striking. Mm-hmm. You're talking to this guy, the whole framing of the documentary is, look at these evil, racist, violent, hysterical white men. Who, by the way, every time they release these documentaries, I can't help but think how normal and like likable the subjects of these documentaries often yes. tend to be. You know, say whatever you want about Jared Taylor or Richard Spencer or whoever else that they interview. Maybe personally you don't like them or you don't like their approach, or maybe you might even think their worldviews are repugnant. But you have these guys. They're always handsome, always well-dressed, always articulate, well-educated, worldly, sophisticated, charming, funny, everything. It's like, oh, I'm supposed to hate these guys.
Yeah.
It doesn't really make any sense to me.
You wouldn't mind them having him as a neighbor, so say that.
yeah, absolutely. And it wasn't just that he was – that Potok, who was charting the declining American white population. I think there was a post-it or another – spreadsheet right next to it, tracing it in Europe as well. So mm-hmm. one of those weird things where, is it bragging? Is this person so ensconced in his, you know, bubble, or is he so victorious that he doesn't think people will see it? Is it a flex? It seems to me that they want you to know what they're doing to you. It's not bad enough that it's being done to you. They want you to know, and on some level, they want you to consent to it. Even if that consent is simply recognition. I'm showing this to you. You see it? Okay, you haven't punched me in the face yet, so you must concede to this. Okay, so we're going to keep going.
Yes.
And that's, you know, that's the mark of kind of the psychopath, which, to go back to Lobachevsky. And these are words, you know, as somebody who's trained in psychology, I've always had a very contentious relationship with the discipline, because we live in a psychological society, for the worse and not for the better. You know, you go back a couple hundred years ago, the top psychological thinkers were Kierkegaard and Nietzsche. And they made truly brilliant and just insightful psychological commentaries on the world, religion and literature. And today you have, Steven Pinker or whoever some of these goofballs are, that really they don't actually add anything of value. They're not crossing any great new threshold. They're very selfish academics. You know, they make these very flimsy arguments. Maybe you don't agree with what Nietzsche wrote, but if you read Steven Pinker and his arguments about groups against group selection are basically amount to, I don't like this. Ergo science, rejects this notion. So I mean, but to get to the point I was making, some of these concepts are very abused and overused, like psychopath, sociopath, and even if you go into the literature, the degree to which these concepts have been bastardized, and maybe even put forth in a malicious kind of way, but maybe that's a conversation for another time, makes it difficult to use them. But I put my own definition into the book, and it's the definition I stick by. And these are like classic psychopathic types, the Mark Potoks of the world. Another gentleman who I reference in the book, Cass Sunstein. Mm-hmm. These are all very weak, effete, generally useless. I mean, I know they have law degrees and things like that. Ostensibly, they have some mental ability, some cognitive ability, but they're political types, really. And in our age, to be a political type is synonymous with being a psychopathic type. They're looking for the easiest route to control people, to control flows of information. Cass Sunstein also is a very classic example of that. He wrote a paper with Adrian Vermeule back in 2008 called On Conspiracy Theories, I believe was the name of the paper. And in it, he's just really hot and bothered. He's all worked up under the collar about the flows of information. And he's talking about how these conspiracy theorists, you know, this isn't the language that he uses, but it's effectively the argument they always make. It's a threat to our democracy, it's a threat to this cherished value and that cherished institution. And he has to admit that most of the conspiracies that he's worried about routinely are vindicated.
Yes.
Nonetheless, it's still a problem that people think this way.
They don't. I mean, conspiracy theory is the organizing conspiracy, rather, is the organizing principle of the world. It's what powerful people do. They call it strategizing or something. They meet and they coordinate and they plan and they have the resources to implement, you know, their ideas, the juice, if you will. The hoi polloi kind of catch on to start talking about it, perhaps trying to figure out what they're doing, then it's called conspiracy theory. It goes back to the CIA and was it memo 103590 or something, where they actually coined that term to disparage and discourage those people looking into these things, just as the Kennedy assassination, John F. Kennedy assassination. Robert Kennedy hadn't been killed yet. So there was just one Kennedy killed at that time, murdered. Yeah, and so now you can't. They don't want people catching on to that. Even though, everyone knows, just in politics, we don't call it conspiracy; we call it lobbying. You know, and that's putting a most positive spin on it. There's always some sort of malevolent or underhanded or alternative motive for all types of things, legislation, even cultural, agendas through Hollywood and through commercials and these things. So that, all conspiracy is two or more people meeting in secret to do something that's immoral or unethical. And that occurs all the time. So, and the more power you have, the more problematic and more concerned the public should be about it. But going back to the Mark Pocock thing, I mean, you go back to the whole white thing. And of course, we've experienced a struggle session, a nationwide struggle session in the wake of the George Floyd incident. His family, apparently, the family that he never took care of, reportedly, is going to be awarded $27 million because of his death. The taxpayer is paying for it in Minnesota. And so we have to suffer that humiliation, at least the taxpayers do. Although it's been determined that he did die of a drug overdose, not because of how he was treated when he was in police custody. But nevertheless, it doesn't matter. We live in a post-truth society. But that was used. You mentioned Ahmaud Arbery. I think that was an attempt to stoke a racial conflict. It didn't work because the facts of the case were just wasn't there. But the George Floyd incident seemed to spark this nationwide struggle session, the riots that the authorities, both local and national, seemed to stand down and just kind of let these things burn out and play out. And we had this whole white guilt stuff. We had you mentioned D'Angelo's book, White Fragility. There's a war on whiteness in the middle of a pandemic, no less, a supposed pandemic. But you say, what's whiteness? Well, we're told that white people don't really exist. It's not legitimate. But nevertheless, it can be pathologized. White people can be blamed for everything. And I've been asked, what is white? And my response is, I'm not really sure what it is. I think a good retort is, college admission boards and corporations appear to know what it is. They have no problem defining it. As we mentioned, the SPLC, Mark Pocock, has no problem defining it. He's charting the decline of the white majority in the country. Department of Housing and Urban Development appears to be able to define whiteness because they target, or at least they identify, certain neighborhoods that are called too white. The New York Times and the Washington Post have no problem defining whiteness because they have criticized the states of Maine and Vermont as being too white. So, we have that game going on. And I see it as sort of a war on heritage America, those Americans who are of European descent who are broadly, they're broadly the white majority. And of course, as you mentioned, Mark Pocock's also charting it in Europe. And so these are the European countries that are historically ethnic based. America is more problematic in that regard, but they're happily, or at least they're aggressively pursuing policies that will lead to the increased demographic decline of the so-called white or European ethnic groups, white ethnics. So they're definitely very concerned with it, and they have no problem defining it.
There's an argument made by a gentleman. You probably know him. He's well known. He wrote a review for my book, Andrew Joyce.
Oh, yes.
And he published a video sometime last year. I think it was titled Kicking Over the Bucket. And the thrust of his argument was yes, we can entertain these ideas. Yes, we can conjure up all of these gargantuan intellectual rebuttals. But at some point, if we understand our interlocutor and we understand the intention behind the arguments and positions that they take, then the only real course of action is to simply kick over the bucket. So if somebody asks me, what even is white? This is not legal advice. I'm not encouraging anyone to actually do this, but
yes.
Go back in time. If I'm outside of the pub with the way back version of the ancestral version of this character, this hypothetical character, I mean, they'd be thrown, in the back of the pub. They'd be beat up in an alley or somewhere. Today, and what I am encouraging people to do is just reject the premise of the question, because it's obviously not something that's intended to further an understanding. It's malicious in intent, and that's what these people do, is they ask these bad faith questions, and they denigrate ideas and concepts which, I mean, I think on their face everyone understands. And even like the whole, one of the issues with racism is that it's reduced in this absurd way to just skin color. It's just, well, I just don't like the pigmentation of your flesh. And that's where all of these issues come from. And the way that these people, spellbinders, as Lobachevsky would call them, are able to make these arguments. I mean, and the real way they're able to make these arguments, as you pointed out, is the total lockstep institutional support that they have. So it's not like these are good arguments. It's not like these are compelling individuals making these arguments. The only reason we're dealing with this is because it's hegemony that has decided it's advantageous to put this forth. They narrow the discourse so that you can only deal with a certain set of confounding variables, because they are, problematic, as they would say, in their nature. You're dealt with a toolkit with a bunch of broken tools or incomplete tools. You can't really make the arguments that you would like to make, because what you're given to combat them verbally with, it's insufficient. Imagine you're in World War I, you're in the dugouts or the ditch or whatever, and they've got rocket launchers and you've got water guns, mm-hmm. water pistols. Like it's set up in a way that you're destined to lose. So they ask these kinds of questions, and the only reasonable response is just reject the premise, kick the bucket open. You're just trying to hurt me. And that's, the other defining feature of these types, is they just want to hurt you more than they want power. This is one of the reasons why I don't like a lot of liberal arguments. I don't like a lot of, say, conservative or alt-right arguments or whatever. When they go back a couple of decades, well, the war in Iraq was just about oil. Or what's happening on Wall Street is just about power, money. What's going on with capitalism is just about growth. It's. I don't think any of that really makes sense. And maybe I'm guilty of defaulting to my discipline. Simplifying, but they want to hurt you. You mentioned humiliation with the struggle sessions. There's no functional reason for that except to harm people, to demoralize them, to culturally defenestrate them. They want to hurt you, and that's why they do the things that they do. They would rather. What's the old crab in the bucket analogy?
Yeah,
like rather than advance themselves. They want you at their level or lower, preferably lower. And that's kind of the mentality that these people have, is they just want to inflict the chaotic, anxious, existential despair that they have on everyone around them. It's what I find is so pernicious, and why I use the term, Lobachevsky's term, pathocrat in the book, because again, we could talk about a kakistocracy, we could talk about gerontocracy. You could go to Aristotle and talk about the timocracy, so on and so forth, oligarchy, whatever the case is. And a lot of that confounds the situation to me. You can't look at there was a gentleman that they brought out to a Jewish, I don't think he was a senator. I think he was from some advocacy group. And it must have been 2 years ago. He came out, I think it was during one of these anti-Semitic hearings, about censorship, or whatever. And he was this, I wish I could remember the guy's name. He was an older Jewish gentleman, glasses, white hair. and he was the most neurotic person that you've ever seen talking about how dangerous the internet is, or censorship, or anti-Semitic commentary on the internet. And as the, whoever was presiding over the hearing was trying to say, you know, hey man, your time is up. Like, let's move on to the next hearing or whatever. He just kept stammering and babbling, and he was very agitated and stuttering, and nothing he said was really making sense. He was totally agitated. And those are the people who have control over the kinds of conversations you can have, over your human resources department, over your hiring practices, over monetary policy. These very agitated, histrionic people. And pathocracy captures that more than the type of governance that they're into, or the type of competency that they possess or don't possess, or the age of the particular. I mean, those are all, maybe they all kind of correlate to one another, and they all certainly do seem to make sense together. The 2020 election was like an octogenarian competition.
Yes.
Just dealing with all these old fogies on Alzheimer's drugs,
raises all types of questions about their behavior, by the way, what type of medication they're on.
Yeah. Well, there was this famous, I don't know how famous it was, but there was a story that got published a few years back about how many of these sitting representatives are on Alzheimer's medication. So, I mean, all these things do. Joe Biden, the perennial loser, he's been losing presidential elections since the 80s, right? I don't remember exactly when he first ran, but it was quite a while ago.
87, yeah.
Yes, not competent, exceedingly old, and not that age is a disqualifying factor, but they're on the wrong side of 77 or whatever the case is, and they're profoundly disturbed people. So I don't want to belabor the point too much, but you know, that concept of the pathocracy, at least on the level of trying to communicate how deranged America is presently and may even be unrecoverable, I find framing it in those terms really cuts through, because a lot of this other stuff is kind of obfuscating. You need a degree in political theory to understand that the world isn't running the way that it ought to be running. You know, the Grug big-brained alliance, like, if you're just some working class guy, or you know, you've got your construction roofing business, but you'd never got your GED, and I'm not saying that in any kind of derogatory way, they have more sense about the way things are than someone like myself with graduate degrees and whatever, you know, supposedly prestigious jobs, whatever the case is. Framing it in with these kinds of devices, I think, is more beneficial.
Yeah, well, someone who has to make his living actually producing something, working with his hands, respecting the laws of gravity, help you stay grounded. You know, you can't just fantasize and come up with ideas of like that there's 57 genders, you know, and you can write laws demanding that people respect, you know, that type of nonsense. Or you can just, you know, there's a limit to things. You have to meet payroll. You know, there's a balance sheet, whereas you just can't print up $1.9 trillion and give out relief. You know, it's what the federal government's doing. And, you talk about the pathocracy. It's obviously that's the standard. It isn't competence, because if you look at the performance of so many mayors and governors this past year, the ones that are, you know, most high profile, the ones that are most, sociopathic and incompetent, as it's coming out now. And of course, that's the question whether or not, you know, what they're being charged with, their incompetency, it might have been what they wanted to achieve, you know, whether it's higher death rates to keep the fear level high, cut back the cost of elderly care in your state, like 13%, like Cuomo succeeded in doing. That's also understanding the true nature of the governing class, the managerial class. And the Americans, I think, now are getting a rude lesson in the true nature of politics and the political class in the country. But still, I think many are still very naive about how things are really run in this country and in the world. No, so.
Yeah, especially right after the election, I heard a lot of people talking about how this was like a watershed moment, because American, the faith that the average American has in their institutions could never, has never been this low. And on one level, I agree. On another level, I don't. And this is one of the arguments I point out in the book is that we don't have, again, going back to Christopher Caldwell, it's not one country with one people. You have the two teams are blue team and red team, and they have fealty to the institutions that they believe represent their interests. So if you're looking for some overarching, like meta-social unity, meta-political unity, that obviously doesn't exist, and it hasn't existed for decades. It's obvious now that it doesn't exist. But that we've got to this point means people were working to this point, which means you go back far enough. Clearly, these fissures were always there. The eruption didn't happen, but the fissures, like the tectonic plates, were shifting the whole time. So is it naivete? I can't remember the gentleman who this quote is attributed to, but it goes something like, you know, if a man's paycheck depends on him not knowing the truth, then expect him to not know the truth. I'm butchering it a little bit, but
yeah, don't expect a man to understand a problem if his paycheck depends on him not understanding the problem. I think it was it Carl Sandburg?
Your guess is as good as mine. I always thought it was James Baldwin. It's not James Baldwin. But yeah, I mean, and that's the situation where lots of people are, they're dependent on the system as it is.
I think it was the guy who wrote The Jungle, the book The Jungle.
Yes.
That's who it is, yeah. I always get those two confused because they're of the same era.
Yes, yeah. And his name also escapes me, although I have a mental picture of him in my brain.
Yeah.
Gosh, it's going to bug me the whole time that we're broadcasting this. I mean, you have a lot of people who are dependent on the system as it stands, for better or for worse. And there isn't a way out for them. And part of that, I think, is people kind of just resigning themselves to the failed state that is America, and even more profound than that, the failed condition of the human race, the human species, which is something I kind of also highlight in the book, that I think at the very end of the book, I found this one very interesting study about self-disgust. It was the only study I could find on this subject, but there's tons of literature in biology and psychology connecting disgust.
I'm sorry, doesn't bother you, Upton Sinclair.
That's the one.
The name just came up to me. I'm sorry. Disturb your train of thought.
Thank God. I'm glad you found that. I'm not going to lie. I was Googling.
I didn't even Google. It just came to my mind. You know, that's how I think it's Upton Sinclair.
Well, God bless you, sir. Yeah, Upton Sinclair. But, you know, there's a lot of literature about disgust. Disgust is related to moral sentiment. It's connected to everything.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you look at, say, put on our libtard hat for a second. Homophobia is just, it's only because of this ancient, barbaric moral sentiment of disgust. Or xenophobia is just connected to this, you know, barbaric moral sentiment. We need to evolve past it, right? So I thought about the opposite. Well, what does self-disgust do? What is self-disgust related to in terms of the way people think and feel about the world? And as it turns out, self-disgust, high levels of self-disgust, are connected to the inhibition of moral judgment. So the more revolting you find yourself, the less likely you are to condemn people for moral transgressions. And I think, Spengler boiled down capitalism to the spirit of money, which I think is an infinitely more useful thing to talk about than say just capitalism is this. You get into this like Mark Fisher territory where it becomes this unknowable, unseeable God that just will never die. And everything is fallen and corrupted until the end of time because of capitalist realism. But if you talk about the spirit of money, it's like, okay, that kind of cuts through it in a way, and you can work towards some end there. I see that similarly by talking about self-disgust and just the kind of like spiritual anorexia that we have, where we're just kind of fatigued by ourselves. We're revolted by our very mortal existential condition. And so while you have lots of people who are financially, maybe socially connected, and that's why they're hesitant, unwilling to make these moral judgments, to try to opt out of the system, whatever the case might be, I think for a great many other people, a great number of other people, it really is this total repulsion with the human experience, the human animal itself. You know, well, I can't such and such, and this goes back to the Ahmaud Arbery George Floyd thing. It's like we couldn't condemn whether the guy George Floyd died because of the knee on his neck or the drug overdose or some other thing. There, and I want to be very careful about putting this line of argument forth because I don't totally want to endorse it. But there were a lot of other actions up to that point that maybe condemned him. You know?
Yeah.
And I don't want to endorse that line of thinking too much because I do believe in a slight way. I mean, I believe in rehabilitation. I do believe a little bit in restoration of a person's character or soul. I don't know if George Floyd fits that bill, but you have these people like, well, I can't judge this other person, right? Because I've done X and Y, Z thing that I'm really ashamed of. Therefore, I will, you said permissive before, I will permit them to continue, you know, along their fallen ways and doing all of these really self-destructive, antisocial, degenerative kinds of practices. It's that baseline spiritual anorexia or just self-disgust that I think is the pervasive condition. And maybe that's the natural conclusion of, you know, as Christopher Lash pointed out, the culture of the self, the century of the self. You become that internally focused. It's inherently, it's desire all the way down. It's inherently dissatisfying. It's inherently destructive. And I think a lot of people who pursue that kind of just eternal subjective gratification, I've seen this in my life, people I've worked with, people I know, invariably they just bottom out and they hit this place of total despair and disgust. And I think that sentiment is behind, you know, transhumanism. It's behind, you know, all this crazy sex work culture. It's behind the sexualization of children. Every evil of our age, I think, fundamentally goes back to that lack of, you know, moral prohibition, that lack of judgment, and the intense feeling of self-disgust that we as a culture have.
Yeah, the idea of somehow moral inhibition was a psychosis, which I think Freud was an advocate of. And his idea was you could, getting into Freud's life, psychoanalyze Freud, you know, and the motivations behind his work and his nephew, Edward Bernays, of course, who cast a long shadow on the 20th century. And so it's the idea, you know, the traditional idea, you know, you say the Christian idea would be your redemption with, you know, go and sin no more. The Catholics have the confessional. And so when you have that, you can avail yourself of I'm Catholic. And I'm aware of just the psychological benefit of being able to avail yourself of the confessional box to gain absolution. It's not only does it help you deal with the reality of sin, which you have done, but also encourage you to not to repeat it and to improve yourself. And there's two ways that a society can deal with guilt. And, you know, the Christian way would be the confessional. The post-Christian way, there is no therapy, really. And so often your reaction is to become actually to double down on your vice. And, you know, you see that with the women who have obtained abortions, or if you're guilty for their promiscuity. You see a lot of in college, a lot of depression in college, and that has to do with what people are doing in college, and especially when they're young. And college is now there to trap a lot of young people, to get people when they're physically adults, but psychologically they're still very much like children, especially in our age with helicopter parents. So they're even more vulnerable than they were maybe a generation or so ago. And also the society is more degenerate. So it's more predatorial, I guess you could say. But it's the idea, I guess you could say, it's misery loves company. And so, you know, I'm not good enough, then who am I to judge? And that's, I mean, that's a sign of a very sick society. If society lacks the ability not to judge, but to discern, morally discern things and to call out bad behavior, destructive behavior. And in those communities where there is no idea of appropriate behavior or sexual discipline, it's been the most catastrophic. You mentioned George Floyd. Obviously, the Black Americans have been, their rates of illegitimacy are approaching 80%, and not surprisingly, the crime rate is through the roof. And that's another side of America's so-called racial issue, is the politics of Black crime, whereas it's not really handled overtly. Black crime, to the extent that it's addressed, it's usually about racism, and no politician, no media figure, major media figures or institutions are addressing the reality of Black crime, which is almost apocalyptic at this point in the country. To the extent that it's addressed, it's usually done indirectly, like, well, white flight, or white people just leave if they can afford it, to live in areas where it's not that much of a problem. So there's as much as we hear about having a frank discussion, dialogue about race, no one really wants that, because really, to the extent that we talk about this issue, it's there to lecture and to admonish the white majority in the country. And of course, I think above and beyond that is a political cultural agenda, global homo, this thing. They want to destroy the middle class. It's back to the bio-Leninism strategy that I alluded to, is it's the attack on the middle from the top and the bottom. And sort of, and I think you could sort of a pincer movement against that. And I think that's what we're seeing now, not only with the Black weaponized Black underclass, minority group, oppressed minority group, that's that idea, but also but what we now call sexual minority groups. You know, this assault on the normal and the healthy. We see that with the promotion of homosexuality. It's sort of its maturation into a political movement, always funded from the top, receiving pretty much the support of the media and Hollywood, but now getting into even more perverse in the transgenderism. And of course, people have charted and have done the research on that, about the vast network of think tanks, medical institutions, and NGOs and foundations that are funding that from the top. The drag queen story hour didn't just happen in your library. It was put there and, funded by the Tide Foundation and these things. So all this it's sort of a revolution from above, and it's high level malevolence. It's something that the bumbling, naive, inchoate middle class, majority is not aware of, and nor can you mobilize it to fight back, because the moment you do that, you'll be accused of racism.
You said redemption, and that was the word I was groping for when I was talking about, George Floyd and the whole thing. And yeah, you tell me, I'm not a practicing Christian, but, central to redemption is the ability to identify and reject evil.
Mm-hmm.
The therapist couch is the modern confessional booth, in like physical space only, but the attitude is very different. Is this very kind of obsessional neurotic fixation on the problem itself, and on understanding the problem and coming to terms with the problem, and all of this kind of euphemistic language, which ultimately boils down to not rejecting that desire to transgress, to turn away from the good. It's all about, and it's one of the reasons why the prison system doesn't work. Rehabilitational therapeutic culture doesn't work, because there's no fundamental rejection of what is evil. And that's the word evil is a four-letter word. It's one of these spooky words that I think, even in our culture, our tradition, we've had a problem grappling with. You go back to, Aristotle, Plato, whatever, there was no evil really. There was just this ignorance. And if you just provided the right information, people would, because of this veneration of logos, of reason, that people would, of course, just change their conduct because they had been given new information. And that's not really how people work. In fact, one of the kind of the great tragedy of these issues of despair is that people kind of do know what they should be doing, but they don't want to do it. Or there's some obstruction blocking them from behaving in the better interests of their higher self. I hear you. Is there something you want to add to that? Or
yeah, I mean, you can discern good because there's logos and there's meaning. You know, there's a teleological meaning to the universe that you can discern. Creation itself is order, and the moment you deviate from the natural law and what is good, you suffer the consequences. Or maybe not the moment, but eventually you do. And you can defy these laws for a while, for a long time. Sometimes you can defy the law of gravity till you hit the ground. You're not really defying; you think you're defying it, but the consequences when you hit the ground. And so people, I mean, there is a way, and I think people know it. They know that they're doing something wrong, and which is why there's such an attempt to try to rationalize it. You know, whether it's misery loves company or I'm not good enough or everyone's doing it. That's the biggest thing, that the mass appeal, the crowd is doing it. Psychologically, you mentioned sort of the weaponized. I want to get back to earlier in the talk about psychology and psychiatry in the 20th century, how it was weaponized, by Madison Avenue, by the intelligence agencies. And it was, sort of the idea of mass events. You could break down people's inhibitions. The main target, of course, was particularly females with the sexual revolution. But when, in the 1960s, rock and roll was a big part of this, and the development of the rock festivals in the 60s, and people have done research, and of course, the bands of that era are directly linked to the CIA, like the Grateful Dead, some indirectly. You have Dave McGowan's research regarding Laurel Canyon. And so there's always these connections, and just even with I was just watching a documentary today, about black exploitation films, and the director Gordon Parks, who's worked for Time Life, and Time Life intersected with, of course, with Skull and Bones and the CIA, but he was hired by the CIA to work with MGM to promote, the black exploitation culture, drugs, sex, violence, derail black progress in the 1960s and early 70s. And so the amount of detail and thought that malevolent forces have to shaping the culture would shock a lot of people, but they just have to do a little research. And so you can do this. And like in the 1960s, you create rock festivals. And of course, obviously the force multiplier, if you will, in this is technology, because you really couldn't have rock and roll without electricity and also without sound, without being able to speakers and radio and stereos and television, these things. So you create a mass culture through entertainment, and this goes back to Edward Bernays. And this type of idea goes back to Edward Bernays because he was actually promoting the idea of the idol with Enrico Caruso, the opera singer, and also the development of movie stars. And you could create a cult, almost like a recreation of the of the gods, of the Greek gods, and you could get people to change their behavior just by promoting these celebrities. And so there's a lot of malevolence out there that a lot of people aren't aware of. They thought that society just kind of fell off the rails. It was sort of second law of social thermodynamics, things fall apart. No, society was pushed in a certain direction. And it was conspiratorial, I'm sorry, in the proper meaning of that word. And of course, culture takes its own momentum after a while. You can push it in a certain direction. This is nudge theory, You can nudge it in a certain direction. And with the amount of technology and resources at your disposal, you can do a lot of damage. And they did. And so we didn't just fall this way. We were nudged in this direction. And the people that did it have names, they had addresses, zip codes. Right. You can identify them. Herbert Marcuse, the Frankfurt School. And all these ideas are all like part of the authoritarian personality, the book that was published by the American Jewish Committee in 1950 that sought to specifically destroy the Christian family because that was the source of fascism based on their theorizing. The next Hitler would come about because if people had strong father figures, that was their thinking. Literally, it boils down to that. And so there's a lot of malevolence out there. And so when you talk about the increased suicide rate or the depression, it's they've been the populace has been driven there. And they want everyone atomized and weak because that creates again a society that is easier to manipulate and control.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you want, I read that McGowan book, by the way, on Laurel Canyon. Tremendous investigative work. Not so much of a fun read because at a certain point you're like, okay, I get it. This person was connected to that guy, and this guy's okay. I get it. It really made it difficult for me to enjoy that. Not that I really ever was into the hippie scene, but it really made it difficult for me to enjoy that kind of stuff. Like Jim Morrison, you know, he mysteriously has this whole catalog of songs, even though apparently he never really studied or could play very many instruments. His father was a military general, I think.
The admiral. Yes, right. He was at the Gulf of Tonkin. He oversaw that non-event.
Yes, right. But you know, what are the two other big movements of that era? The psychedelic movement. Timothy Leary had a lot of suspicious CIA connections. Gloria Steinem founded Miss Magazine, basically CIA bankrolled. And those are two mass movements that have long surpassed their kind of humble beginnings, where they're now just feminism and psychedelic new age mysticism are just so ubiquitous. It's in the air. It's like miasma. It's all around you. Yeah. You breathe it in, you take it in, and you can't resist it. You can't even trace really, like you said, unless you do really, really diligent work, you can't even trace its origins because it just seems like this naturally emergent thing that just sprung up because it was like in the air, man, or it was the right thing to do, or culture was evolving, man. And that's obviously not the case. I mean,
yeah, a figure like Gloria Steinem and even Timothy Leary, they're change agents, or it's almost like they're a concentrate that's put into the well and it poisons the well, you know, whereas not everyone's going to mimic or emulate Gloria Steinem, everything she does, but they'll take in or internalize enough of it. And that's what feminism does. You know, the idea of pushing women into the workforce and out of the home where they can be taxed and exploited. And that's sold as progress, despite the deleterious effects, the deplorable effect it's had on the quality of life, the family life. And of course, that gives us the children, which can then be driven nuts or depressed because now they're latchkey kids who come home to an empty house and watch MTV. You know, the culture of vampires provide for them. And, you know, and then, of course, that family's also going to need two cars. It's going to consume differently. And there's a whole, and some of this just happens. But I would have to think, if I can figure it out, I'm sure an MBA can plan this out. And it's a business model for managing the world and creating a debt-ridden consumer society, which is what they've created.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And one of, I don't know that they were closely linked together, but they were part of the same movement. Terence McKenna. I spent a lot of time listening to a lot of his lectures, you know, read one or two of his books, very, you know, connected. And it's just kind of miraculous how these people always end up wanting to create the same kind of world that the political overlords do or did. And Terence McKenna regularly spoke about depopulating. About a massive population cull, specifically eliminating, I can't remember if he said he wanted to eliminate one third of the male population or reduce the male population to one third. Either way, we're talking about millions and millions and millions of people dead because men are the problem. He called it the dominator culture. So what today, you know, like with university culture, it would just be toxic masculinity. Well, the problem is, And he would say this once in a while, kind of slip it in here in the sly to be like the self-effacing, cool academic, like, yeah, it's the white man, bro. It's the white man in the black suit. You know, if we just get rid of them, then female consciousness can flourish and no wars will be started because women are nonviolent or whatever, which, I mean,
yes,
you probably know this, like more than 50% of domestic violence incidences are instigated by women. It's like a narrow ratio, but women edge that.
Yeah, and probably more because men don't report it.
Yes, this is a very good point.
Yeah, so, this is the archaic revival that he advocates, and primitivism. And of course, if you want to dominate a people, you want them to be primitive and easier easier to manipulate. Does it funny thing? You talk about the war on masculinity. Tucker Carlson ran a segment last week about the U.S. military. A couple of them, because he responded to the Pentagon's response, but it was talking about how China has acknowledged there's a crisis in masculinity, and they see it as a form of Western corruption. I think they're largely correct about, and so now they're and they get, maybe this is easy to do in a society like China. Now they're promoting masculinity, particularly in the military, for obvious reasons. But whereas the United States, you have Joe Biden talking about paternity flight suits and form-fitting combat wear for women and haircuts. And it's, you know,
wait,
it's
just, what? Fraternity flight suits?
Fraternity flight suits for, I guess, female aviators. They're pregnant and they're, you know.
Wow.
Now, to me, being pregnant means that means you're not ready to be deployed, you know. But then we have a cult, a society which worships child sacrifice in a form of unrestricted abortion, but the Pentagon has to accommodate pregnant soldiers. It's, yeah, one of these. This is obviously a military that doesn't take its core mission seriously. You know, perhaps it never has, actually. The military has always been a social engineering, huge social engineering. So has war, actually. Always been a huge social engineering operation anyway. But it's, yeah, you know, you have, so this, and obviously if you want to weaken a society, you want to take out the men, right? And so the war on masculinity is a big part of that, because really it's the men who are going to stand up to a lot of this stuff. It's the women. It's not, you know, women will tend to be much more compliant in these things. So you want to, and here's an example. It's like Mario Cuomo or Andrew Cuomo, who's now being told he should resign because of not because of the thousands of people he killed in the retirement homes. It's because he has a history of asking subordinate female subordinates out on dates, which is very masculine, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not aware of any accusations of assault, you know, nor retribution. It's just women who don't like the fact that this old guy was hitting on them. But again, what's being highlighted is the fact that here's this toxic masculine, toxic masculinity that he should resign over, not the fact that he presided over the destruction of the state's economy and oversaw thousands of unnecessary deaths in the nursing homes. We all guess we have our priorities.
Yeah. Naughty Italian white man, don't ask out those young girls.
Yes.
But so you mentioned the authoritarian personality, and obviously Adorno, Marcuse, mm-hmm. Eric Fromm, Wilhelm Reich.
All Baptist?
Yes. Yeah, funny. Absolutely. And specifically, Reich and Fromm, you know, were very concerned with the libidinal energy as a revolutionary resource, having this great wellspring of potential to dramatically change culture. And we need to, I think this is Reich's work more than anybody else, we need to instigate that sexual energy at as early an age as possible. So, I mean, if you want to destroy men, you destroy them when they're children. You make, because the only way, I'm not a father, but I've worked in some capacity. The only way a child's mind develops healthfully is they work in these kind of very rigid, schemata-like ways where they, if you just imagine like the inside of your head is just like these filing cabinets with labels on them, and children just go around and they're collecting experiences and they're like, okay, which filing cabinet does this one go into? Right. And it has to go into that filing cabinet, and that one can't commingle the filing cabinets, because then the conceptual development of the child's mind becomes very confused. Right. So, I mean, anyone who's a parent, you know, this is probably a little bit different today, but when I was a kid, you know, like the terrifying moment you walk down the street and two guys are holding hands and the kid turns to mom or dad, says, why are those two guys holding hands? And it's like, it's creating this like adaptation process in their mind where you had these, you know, metaphorical filing cabinets where very specific types of information were put in so that the child could order their experience, make predictions about the world, understand how they relate to everything around them. And you just muddle all that up, and it becomes difficult to have a ordered prediction-making, device in your head that you can rely on, and you can develop, you can trust your instincts about how to relate to different things. So, but anyway, so like they were very, so obviously the paternalistic, fascistic family structure had to go, but alongside that had to be this liberation of childhood sexuality, because liberation of man, of freeing us from the evils of the world, was predicated on sexual liberation, which, I mean, I've read E. Michael Jones. He makes a very compelling case. The exact argument opposite is the result of that kind of argument. Liberating sexual desire actually imprisons you. And that's the great irony of liberating desire at all, is because you become subordinated to those desires. You can never totally satisfy them. You know, as Lacan points out, that the satisfaction of desire is this extremely anxiety provoking event, because there's only more desires. And they keep perpetuating further and further unsatisfiable desires. And if the fascist, quote unquote, can be defined as anything, in any way, it's somebody who recognizes the futility of pursuing desire to the exclusion of everything else.
Yeah, and it's libido dominandi, the use of sexual liberation as political control. And that's obviously pornography in the West, particularly in the modern era. Another example where technology is a force multiplier, because it simply wasn't practical until photography and film came online. And for the longest time, it was restrained because you had, you know, local obscenity laws. But then through legal maneuvering and agitation, obscenity became freedom of speech, protected speech. 1970s, you had, you know, Deep Throat was declared to be, you know, protected, had a redeeming quality, I guess you could say. But our irony is, as they're applying free speech to obscenity, free speech applies less and less to political speech. So to this very day, the internet will not, you can download or stream the most offensive pornography in the world on the internet, but various platforms will strictly restrict political speech. And that's one of these inversions that we've experienced in the West. Largely from agitation from the Baptist, as a but you're right. And Wilhelm Reich, I think it was a mass psychology of fascism. He observed, I think, in the 20s and 30s in Austria, before he hightailed it out of there, that you wouldn't want to argue theology, you know, with a seminarian. You just talk about sex, and pretty soon he forgets about theology. That was his strategy. And look what they've done with music and movies, and of course with the internet. It's much worse now. And you're right about corrupting the youth with this, because when you're young, children do have these categories. It's very simple, and this is how you develop healthy aspirations in a child, give them an orderly existence. This is why family is very important, an intact family, mother and father, is very important. And it's why it's been so targeted, because they realized that if you do disrupt the family, you can set society off on a course. You know, you can set it off course. And that was, again, it goes back to planning. It goes back to Burleson or Jaffe Memorandum of 1969. Planned Parenthood had a meeting in Pennsylvania where they talked about doing this very thing. It was done in conjunction with the U.S. government, the Population Council. Is how do they promote popular? How do they control the population? They do it by promoting divorce, sexual liberation, homosexuality. And if you do that, people will have less children, obviously. And if the family is broken up, children are subject to more trauma and confusion, and you actually get more homosexuals. And so they're indirectly admitting that psychosexual, you know, disorientations like homosexuality is something that can really be created with trauma. And although at the same time they're agitating to have it removed from the DSM, a list of psychological disorders, but they were in a way kind of admitting it with that strategy. So again, it's another example where you can you're weaponizing, you know, you're targeting the culture directly through a control of the media through through Hollywood and television. A lot of stuff is promoted on television, and if you just go to what people stream now on Netflix or you know what's considered standard fare, I mean, there's no doubt that you know we've gone come a long way, you know, since the 1970s in that area.
Yeah, you mentioned homosexuality. The thing that is interesting to me, I was coming of age in the early 2000s when the first major political push for legalization of what was the name of the bill? Marriage Equality Act, mm-hmm. Is that what it was called? And it was wholly dependent on the pseudoscientific assumption that there was a genetic predisposition, and this was towards homosexuality. And that was a concept that activists were always very leery of, because they always wanted to emphasize the free choosing aspect, and they were leery of the potential eugenic blowback of, oh well, if we can identify the gay gene, then we'll just simply genetically eradicate homosexuals. But anyway, that was a claim that was made without any supporting evidence. I don't think you could say that was what won the Marriage Equality Act in terms of in the court of public opinion, so to speak.
Well, the court, I mean, it was never passed. The Supreme Court more or less passed it with the Obergefell decision.
But right.
Usually, anytime they put it up for the vote, it failed. Even in liberal California, it failed overwhelmingly. So this was an example of popular sovereignty or popular government. Yeah. This was imposed from above, and then they normalized. The same thing they did with abortion. You know, mm-hmm. You know, it was basically legal in California, New York, and it's basically an attempt by a handful, largely Jewish people. That's what Bernard Nathanson admits that in his book. He eventually converted to Catholicism, but he was a Jewish activist. He said that legalized abortion was a Jewish thing, and it was basically Jews in New York and California agitating to get it passed nationally. And to this day, if you look at the geography of abortion, it's primarily a bi-coastal thing. You know, mm-hmm. But again, the court imposes it, puts its imprimatur on it, and then we call it law. You know, but it was never passed. You know, for the most part, states had various laws, but same thing with gay marriage, so-called gay marriage. It never received popular support. But now this was a few years ago. Now we have to accept it as law. You know, as if it's just the way things are, and you know.
It's funny you say that. It's literally a geographical pincer, right? If mm-hmm. the middle of America is symbolic of the middle class, and you have the high and low of New York and California just pushing all of these things that people don't want. But what I was getting to was that there was a study that got published last year, 2019, basically saying, yeah, there's no such thing as a gay gene. There's literally no evidence for it. It was just some like rhetorical device. And then earlier this year, a survey was published showing that Gen Z is effectively the gayest population or the gayest demographic in American history. And so it's just, you know, the I guess what I want to extract out of that is that the spellbinding pathocratic class, they will use the kind of prevailing systems and concepts and arguments of their day with the power of hegemony to advance the things that they want. And once they have advanced that, they remove the pretext that was there in the first place. So, I mean, it goes back to the whole kicking over the bucket thing, where there actually is no material substance to any of the arguments or positions they want to put forth. It's just this very flimsy rhetorical device supported by the courts, the universities, the media, the banking institutions. And it doesn't really take a lot to refute it logically or rhetorically, other than courage to do that, because it's a paper tiger. There's nothing really there other than the hegemony itself isn't a paper tiger, but the force of the arguments and the positions being put forth themselves, there's just nothing there. They can't support themselves. But yeah, it's just funny to me. It just flies in the face of all of the arguments that they make, and it's also discouraging to see that, you know, how successfully those trends have been pushed, because they do seem, I don't want to be too pessimistic here, but they do seem at this point to be kind of irreversible.
Well, it's the power of media and propaganda. And if you can suggest, obviously the power of suggestion, and children are very open to suggestion. And so if you're dedicated to messing children up, you can do it. You know, what if you, I've always had to pose to me about, you know, the difference between the two sexes. And, you know, I use the word sex, not gender specifically for a reason, because, you know, so, you know, the reason why gender was adopted goes back to, actually, I think it was, what's your name, the notorious RBG who started using gender in the 1970s when she was a feminist advocate or activist, using gender in terms of sex in the language. And it was done for a specific reason. But this is where you create a toxic culture. And if you create an environment where, the sexes are no longer distinct from one another, complementary to one another, and you do this for 20, 30 years, you do it with sports and these things, trying to integrate girls into boys' sports, or integrate girls into the Boy Scouts, you know, at the same time promoting homosexuality, letting open homosexuality, out of the closet, active homosexuals in schools, promoting it, sponsoring clubs and these things. At the same time, you have children growing up in broken homes where their normal patterns of discovery and courtship are disrupted. Yeah, they're no longer, you know, church dances you go to, and you don't have the example of the mother and father at home, which is a very important, I think, attribute of real sex education. Or you don't have siblings. People used to come in large families where they had sisters and brothers, they had cousins, and you could observe the opposite sex, you know, the sexes, how they behaved. You can create a whole lot of confusion out there, and they have. And they've done it with media and with music, and they've done it with the big androgynous push with fashion. There's a law being literally being considered in California that would outlaw gender-specific aisles and clothes and toys in California in department stores. You know, so why have a law for that? I mean, it's nonsense. It says a lot now that you have various, I think in 20 states, at least 20 states, there are laws now being proposed to specifically protect women's sports programs from transgendered males. Men who pretend to be women who are flooding girls' sports programs and crowding women out, of course, because the obvious sexual, physical difference between men and women. But the fact that you have to write and sign a law like that says a lot. And the ACLU, which used to be, left, but you could arguably say they were somewhat principled in such things like civil liberties. The ACLU now is becoming an advocate for transgendered people. Men saying it's a civil right for boys to flood girls' sports programs. And the ACLU, it turns out, of course, the ACLU was heavily funded by the Pritzker family, which is a Jewish banking family, governor of Illinois. But they're a big advocate of transgenderism. They support research. They give money to, like, University of Illinois, Harvard. They support foundations which provide the nuanced and complex research that Dr. Rachel Levine referenced when he was being grilled by Senator Rand Paul. Of course, Rachel Levine is the guy who pretends to be a woman who's being confirmed for the position of Assistant Secretary of Health, despite the fact that he's a man who thinks he's a woman who's obese.
The obesity thing had actually slid past me. You're right. I was like, oh, wow.
He's not very healthy.
The whole other thing, like, had totally clouded my judgment. I had not even seen the body size. Yeah, that's pretty gross.
But this is being seriously entertained, and this is a part. I think this is part humiliation, right? That you talked about earlier. Even we're having to entertain this, have to debate these things. Again, this is from the top down, though. I mean, there's no groundswell support for this stuff. There's no mass support for this nonsense.
No, and there never has been. And that was the other thing I wanted to. I guess one of the One of the books that was really influential in my thinking, also published by Imperium Press, is this guy, Chris Bond, who wrote Nemesis back in 2019. When I still had my own broadcast, I interviewed him shortly after the book was published, and he makes a very convincing argument that across every discipline for hundreds, thousands of years, you've seen this Juvenalian model where you have, you know, the central powers, the peripheral powers, the intermediary powers, and they're all kind of jockeying with one another. So you have the emergence of money as a way to disrupt the natural, the power structure that existed at the time. You have all of these things that we think of as just the natural, naturally occurring, free-flowing, bottom-up process of progress or development or evolution or whatever you want to call it. And really they're devices that are implemented to advance particular power interests. And anything you want to look at over the last, especially obviously over the last 2, 3, 4 decades, but in the last 100 years, it was done, accomplished by these top-down processes where it was organized, planned out beforehand, and then implemented, and all of these lesser power institutions effectively operated to force that on the population. You mentioned McGowan before. None of the groups that came out of Southern California really could even play their instruments. All of their songs were written for them. They were terrible stage performers. I think the Yardbirds, well, they were English, but
the Birds, yeah.
The birds yeah. Who I was thinking of, right. Couldn't play their instruments, didn't really write their own songs, but they were pushed by recording industries because it advanced a certain look and feel. It jived with the cultural changes that were happening at the time. It was always artificial. And it's hard for people to see that because there's so many layers of obfuscation. You see the thing on TV. You hear the story that they're telling you about their life. They got a nice smile. They got some nice clothing on. They're kind of attractive. You believe them. But there's so many layers of obfuscation. And the way that neoliberal power seems to achieve its success is by deliberately foiling any attempt at formalizing the power that it has. So like all of the names that you and I have mentioned on this broadcast, you have to do some really hard labor to find out who these people, because they don't want you to know who they are. It's kind of a meme to say they've got addresses and PO boxes and things, but it's true. But you have to look really, really hard to find them because they don't want to be known. And that's, in some sense, that's the real power that they have, is that they're able to influence all these things. And yet, even the people that we point to as being like shakers and movers, Sheldon Adelson, Adelson, mm-hmm. George Soros, name any other names you'd like. Even that we're able to know who those people are is itself a kind of ruse, because they become a kind of Girardian scapegoat where we apply all of our attention to them. It's one of the things that is like so irritating about like the Q phenomenon, or even like the Alex Jones phenomenon. And I like Alex Jones, and I'm sympathetic at least to the people involved in Q. But they fixate on the objects that you're permitted to know about, that you're permitted to hate, without even understanding that, yeah, George Soros is a major player, but there are people behind him. I mean, I'd never even heard of the Atlantic Council until a few years ago.
Yeah.
You know, and these are things like you can be involved in this for a very long time, and some stuff it just continually remains obscured.
Well, look, for the longest times, if you talked about Bilderberg, people called you a conspiracy nut. As if they didn't meet? As if what? You're saying they don't meet? And this isn't significant? I mean,
The Council on Foreign Relations has a podcast. I just laughed myself into a fit when I saw it on iTunes. I was like, all right, you're just playing games with me now.
Yeah, and the Council of Foreign Relations, and their origins go back to, you know, right after World War One. This ties into the banking and oil interests. I think the Pratt House is their mansion up in New York, and he was, I think, an heir to one of the heirs to the Standard Oil fortune. And of course, Pratt George P. Shultz, the former Secretary of State under Reagan, his middle name is Pratt. So there's the power structure. I mean, it's like, and it's, you know, and the Council for Foreign Relations is basically the, it's a coordinating body, a think tank that represents the interest of the elite. And they were there to set up where they could go in at the time, kind of take over the government or influence the government at a critical time, particularly after World War II. You know, they could get America set up for the Cold War. Yeah, so, you know, that's how important these institutions are.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, it's again, you know, whether it's Davos, everyone, we know a lot of, there's been a lot of talk about the World Economic Forum and, you know, and Davos now, but that's another, you know, important, you know, confab or gathering, and not to mention all the secret ones that probably occur, you know, so.
Yeah, the IMF is ubiquitous now. You look on a conspiracy forum, everyone knows about the IMF, but there'll be another one next year, and there'll be another one the year after that. And as these, it became kind of de rigueur a couple of years ago for people to just crash Bilderberg because Alex Jones had brought such attention to it that it, that they had to actually hire more tense security and not make all the same kind of information publicly available because they had got too much heat and they. Suddenly people had interested eyes. There's that guy whose name I can't quite remember. Maybe 2017, 2018, went on to Tucker Carlson and kind of ripped him a new one, who also apparently was like one of these big anti-Bilderberg types. I think he was maybe from Holland or something. Yeah, they get too much heat. And that's obviously the opposite of what they want. But I'm quite a few years away from my peak as a conspiracy theorist. I'll have to... I'll have to bow out of that conversation.
So, well, I said I'd have you for an hour and a half. I think we're at an hour and a half.
Yeah, right on. It was a good talk. I appreciate you having me on.
So the book, where should people get it?
I would really, really appreciate, and the publisher would really appreciate if you head over to imperiumpress.org, I-M-P-E-R-I-U-M, press, P-R-E-S-S.org. And order a copy of American Extremist, The Psychology of Political Extremism. It's available, I think, on literally every other platform that sells books, but they, especially the Amazons of the world, they take pretty, they extract their pound of flesh.
Yes.
So we would like Imperium Press. They're a growing publishing outfit. They only have about five or six other books, but in this year, they're set to publish at least a dozen more. Thomas Carlyle is a book. Putting out one of Thomas Carlyle's books out soon. Palmer De Maistre, I can't pronounce this guy's name, De Maistre.
Joseph De Maistre?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, he's an old, I don't call him right wing, but he was a critic of the French Revolution. Yeah.
Yeah. If you know on Twitter, I only know him by his handle, RealThomas777. He's publishing a book on the Nuremberg trials. Basically, he's making the argument that that was the kind of the genesis of the neoliberal legal juridical system that we have today. So there, I mean, there's so much great stuff they're publishing. They're starting a podcast. I think there's some talks about audiobooks, but anyway, imperiumpress.org, pick up a copy. If you like it, then definitely head over to Amazon and leave a review because we like to use that platform to get the book out into wider audiences that it might not otherwise receive. Who knows how long the book will be on Amazon, but as long as it's up there, if you want to drop a 5-star review, a rating, we'd really appreciate it.
Okay, excellent. Well, yeah, I read it. It's a very thoughtful, provocative book, but it's also it's a good analysis, and I liked it because you referenced a lot of works that I had read, so it was very easy for me. But it's well written. It's an easy read, so it's not laborious to read it. It's well written. So, and it is. It makes you think about these things. And I put it up there with Caldwell's book. It's one of the books I really liked a lot. Was his book on Age of Entitlement. It was just it kind of encapsulated all these issues, or it dealt with all these various issues that we're dealing with now as we're trying to sort of grew up all the way through this early the 21st century and find out what's really going on and how do we try to rectify or at least get us back to a more righteous path before things go too crazy as if they haven't already. So I do hardly recommend it. So
I appreciate that.
Thank you so much. I'll let you go. Let you have enjoy some of your weekend. I'll post it soon. When I do, I'll send you the link.
Fantastic. Thanks a lot, Tim.
Okay, great. Thanks so much.